the Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Virginia.
Good morning, Council. Welcome to the virtual session of the Supreme Court of Virginia.
Canova Land and Investment Company versus Lynn et al. Michael G. Gallarizzo, Gregory L. Arbogast, Appellants Counsel, Robert J. Zelnick, Brian M. McCormick, Appellees Counsel.
Is it Mr. Gallarizzo who will argue first?
It's Mr. Arbogast, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Arbogast, you have 15 minutes to begin, and you may begin now.
Thank you, Your Honor. Before I begin, may I reserve up to 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes.
Thank you. This court is asked to decide whether the facts and circumstances of this case warrant a departure from the general rule and historic maxim that absolute restraints on alienation of property are void as a matter of public policy, as set forth in Section 4.2 of the Restatement of Donative Transfers and as adopted by this court in 2016 in Hamm versus Hazelwood. They do not.
Isn't your biggest problem is that this isn't a restraint on alienation of the property. It's a restraint on the use of the property.
Well, Your Honor, it is a restraint on use in form, but a restraint on alienation in substance. And that is addressed in Section 3.4 of the Restatement of Donative Transfers, which is the section dealing with use restraints. And I turn Your Honor's attention to Comment B of Section 3.4 of the Restatement, which says that a use restraint in form, but a restraint on alienation in substance, is in effect a restraint on alienation and is treated under the restraint on alienation rules. And it
Counsel,
goes on to get...
Counsel,
yes.
We're familiar with that particular law. Let me zero in on some of the facts of this case, because that your argument about restraint on alienation, trying to determine just how narrow that is. In the 2006, this entity became a corporation.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did that not violate the restraint on alienation? It went from being an unincorporated association to being a separate legal entity, a corporation.
So, Your Honor, that change did not violate the restraint on alienation because, as Your Honor is probably aware, for a significant period of time in Virginia history, churches were not permitted to incorporate. That law changed, and churches were permitted to incorporate. And the
that's
Virginia
correct,
legislature,
Council, but as a member of the legislature, I sponsored that law, so I'm fairly familiar with it. But my question to you is this: there was no requirement to become a corporation. It was
That's
a
true.
Voluntary decision to go from being one legal entity, Woodbine Baptist Church, an unincorporated association, to being an entirely different legal entity, Woodbine Family Worship Center and Christian School, a Virginia corporation. Why didn't that violate the restraint on alienation?
Well, it certainly could have, Your Honor, and frankly, if it didn't, then the subsequent transfer 1 year later, which was the pledge as security in the deed of trust, would constitute a transfer and would be a transfer out of trust. But if
but
it did...
Is it your argument that it did? You
yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so that violated the restraint on alienation. Let me go to a second question. Is this Baptist Church a member of the Southern Baptist Convention?
I believe that there was testimony that it was, Your Honor, and just to
and
be clear,
when was
with
the Southern Baptist, when was the Southern Baptist Convention created?
I believe there was testimony that it was back in the 1950s, 1960s, somewhere around
so
that.
So when it went from a member of one Baptist denomination, or perhaps not even a denomination, because Baptist churches are congregational churches, when it then moved to an entirely different denomination, did that not violate the restraint on alienation?
It certainly could have, Your Honor, but the point being that all of these potential violations, whether it be in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 2006, or 2007, is beyond the 10-year statute of limitations for someone to come forth and assert their rights to real property. So
I'm not asking who has the right under those circumstances. I'm trying to determine how many times the restraint on alienation has been violated with no one ever being concerned about it.
Well, we certainly contend at least one, which was the conveyance under the deed of trust in 2007. Your point's well taken that it certainly could have been in 2006, too, and it certainly could have been when the denomination was changed decades before that. But under any event, it's been sold out of trust. It's been violated. The violation occurred beyond the statute of limitations that someone can come forth and assert their right of reverter. And so whether it was extinguished by virtue of transfer or is void as a matter of public policy, in either event, it should no longer restrain and encumber the property and should be stricken by this court in the action to quiet title.
So counsel, let me now ask a hypothetical, but based upon complete facts, and that I'm going to use the church that I attend. The church that I attend was Third Presbyterian Church, a member of the Presbyterian Church of the United States of America. Within the past decade, it went from being an unincorporated association to being a corporation, and it also separated from its denomination. It went from being a member of the Presbyterian Church of America to the Evangelical Covenant Order of Presbyterians. So your argument, if we accept it, is that if anyone gave a real estate to Third Presbyterian Church, PCUSA, more than a decade ago, with the intent that it be used by that church, that in effect it is a restraint on alienation.
The real property portion of it, yes, Your Honor. There's certainly a distinction between, you know, trusts created and real property restrictions in deeds. And as a trust instrument, a conveyance to trustees to use for the use and benefit of a specific a church would be enforceable because the court of equity has jurisdiction over the charitable trust to reform it if and when necessary.
Do you realize the magnitude of the unintended consequences if we accept your argument?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that's the case, because if you accept my argument, conveyances to trustees for the use and benefit of a church is a valid trust instrument. That is not really subject to attack. What it is when someone wants to then convey the property, when someone wants to pledge the property pursuant to a deed of trust, they seek permission from the court of equity, who can say, yes, I believe that this is within the intent. Yes, you have the power to do this. Yes, I believe that this is necessary. I ratify this action and I authorize it.
Counsel, I dare say that there are innumerable churches and innumerable courts in the Commonwealth of Virginia that would not be happy to take on that role.
That is the role as trustees for a particular property. If something is conveyed in trust to trustees, then the trustees have to act in accordance with the trust instrument. And if they want to violate that trust instrument or go outside, then they have to seek permission from the court to do so. Now, the court is authorized to ratify that action, and the court is authorized to say, yes, that's within the intent of the trust instrument, or I believe the trust instrument to no longer be reasonable, so I will reform it. But as trustees of public property, effectively, if it's property for a charitable organization or church, then that is their obligation to ensure that their actions when transferring property outside of trust are in compliance with the trust instrument. And so that portion of it is perfectly fine and valid and a good and valid conveyance. But once that trust is destroyed, once it's transferred out of trust, like pledged in a deed of trust, whether with or without authorization, the only thing that we have left is a real property restriction, of which a court of equity does not have jurisdiction to look at and to determine, yes, in this circumstance it's reasonable, no, in this circumstance it's not reasonable. That real property restriction is void as a matter of public policy. When it's simply a trust instrument, when it's a grant to trustees who have authority to act for the public interest, then that is valid and enforceable so long as it remains in that trust. But as you pointed out, Your Honor, that's not the case with this property. This property no longer remains in that trust. The trustees lost it, whether it be by change of denomination, by transfer to a corporation, or by pledge of security for a loan. Certainly, at least by pledge of security for the loan, They violated the trust, and the only thing we have left then is not the grant of a trust or a trust instrument. The only thing we have left is a real property restriction. And the only thing that can happen then to the real property restriction is it's either void or not void. And if it absolutely and forever encumbers and restrains the alienation of property, then it's void. If it's not absolutely encumbers and restrains alienation forever, then it would be reasonable and not void. And so I don't think that it would have the far-reaching impacts that might necessarily first appear on their face, because this case presents a unique circumstance, which is that the property was conveyed out of trust without authority, and it was done so more than a decade ago. And so this is a relatively narrow question. The facts and circumstances of this case, where you have a property where the trust instrument was breached and the property was conveyed out of trust, and the only thing that remains is a real property reverter clause to be analyzed only under real property law and not trust law, then is that void against public policy?
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. If I may I interject a question there? I'm going back to the restatement. As you point out, the restatement says that indirect restraints are, quote, a more amorphous category, end quote. And then you go to 3.5 to determine whether or not it has a rational basis. Well, I think you're going to tell me the next question I ask has a simplistic assumption, but I'd like to know why it's not a good enough assumption. Isn't it rational for society to allow a donor who is, in this case, back in the 1800s, who has 100% fee simple interest, to make a charitable gift, and that the effect on modern society of charitable giving, even though it does indirectly restrain, at least through market value factors, the ability to buy and sell it, isn't that a reasonable thing? And first off, is that too simplistic? I know you're going to tell me it is, but tell me why it is, because I don't understand why it isn't.
Sure, because what the net effect is, because the restraint is so narrow, the net effect is that it encumbers property forever to the use of one specific person, like the example in comment B to section 3.2 of the restatement. So if the conveyance was to be used as a place of worship, candidly, that's probably valid. Frankly, even if the conveyance was just generally to be used as a church, probably valid. And maybe even if the conveyance was to be used as a Baptist church, maybe valid, because there is then a number of people who can use the property, other Baptist churches. But this is one specific church for one specific isolated use, and that forever encumbers and restrains property until the end of time, whether that church ceases to be in existence or not, whether we completely change the laws of religion in this country or not, no matter what the change, that property is forever encumbered, and that's what the law does not allow, and that's not what's consonant with general real property principles, which is that you should be able to use and alien your property within reasonable restrictions.
Can I follow up with another question? Sorry, yes, Your Honor.
Right ahead. Go ahead.
One more question. You say that it would not be unreasonable if it simply said, well, it needs to be used by a Southern Baptist church. But why would equitable principles distinguish between a Baptist denomination or a Baptist-leaning congregational church and a particular Baptist church? Why is the social policy behind favoring charitable giving and providing charitable conveyances with a presumption of legitimacy, why is that one distinction a big deal to you?
Well, Your Honor, because it creates at least a limited pool of people to whom the property can be transferred. And what we have here is no pool of people to whom the property can be transferred. Okay. So that
I don't
is
want to eat up your, you're yes, eating your up Honor. Your rebuttal. I apologize if I took you over.
No, Your Honor. I'm perfectly happy to answer questions. With that, I'll conclude until rebuttal.
You have 1 minute and 38 seconds left. Mr. Zelnick?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Robert Zelnick, and I represent the heirs of Levi Lynn and Edna Lynn, who were the grantors in the 1875 deed. My clients are Carolyn Lynn and Cheryl Crawford. And as the argument has proceeded this morning, it is clear we agree with the position that this deed does not contain a restriction on alienation of property, that rather, as it clearly states in the deed, this is a restriction on use. The very language of the deed says to revert to the grantors or their heirs if it ceases to be used for the purpose expressed in this deed. So the statement Mr. Arbogast just made, that if the church no longer existed, then the restriction would continue, would clearly be a false statement, because once the church is not being, once the property is not being used for the purposes stated in the deed, the restriction is no longer possible or in effect. We believe that this restriction on use is analogous and virtually indistinguishable from the restriction that this court approved in the School Board versus Dowell case. And as you know, in that case, the grant of the property was limited for the purposes of a public school. And at some point in time, after it had been used as a public school for a number of years, the county stopped using it for school purposes and the property was unused. And at that point, the heirs came forward and claimed the property. And when it went to this court, you found that the restriction on use was valid and made a determination that the heirs were, in fact, the lawful and rightful owners of the property. We submit that the finding in the Dow case is no different. The facts are no different. The legal principle is no different than the facts in this case. And that the Dow case is one of the cases that the trial court relied on in making the finding that the use restriction in this case was reasonable and enforceable. What the trial court found and what has been found in numerous cases is this is a fee simple determinable estate with possibility of reverter. That is exactly what was found in the Dowell case, and that's what the trial court found in this case. We also believe that even if a determination was made that this is a restriction on alienation, even if that finding was to be made, the fact is that charitable gifts are exempt from the rule that would otherwise limit restraints on alienation. As Mr. Arbogast pointed out, the question is one of public policy. And this court has expressly recognized that in the Lips versus First American case, which concerned a due on sale clause, where the court says that the heart of the questions on alienation issues are public policy. So we believe that even if it was found to be a restriction on alienation, the overriding paramount public policy of encouraging philanthropy and encouraging gifts to charitable organizations, and there's no dispute that the church is a charitable organization under many, many cases that we've cited in our brief, that would be sufficient to overcome whatever claim might be made that this constituted a restraint on alienation. Similarly, this court has previously found that the rule against perpetuities does not apply to gifts that are made, charitable gifts that are made. And the rule against perpetuities has the same rationale as the rule that prohibits restraint on alienation, the idea that somebody from years ago can control what happens to the property today. But in the Lyons case, this court found that the fact that it was a charitable gift exempted the transaction from the rule against perpetuities. I think it's also important to recognize in this case that Canova has never challenged the finding of the trial court that this was a charitable gift. That is not one of the assignments of error that were raised. So that the fact that the trial court made that finding is conclusive for purposes of this appeal.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. May I ask you a question?
Certainly.
It obviously, as you point out, is not a direct restraint on alienation under 3.4 of the restatement, but it also is hard to not characterize it as an indirect restraint on alienation under 3.5. And it's not like the restatement is some code that we have to follow. It's just academics trying to restate, generally, with some exceptions, what their understanding of the common law is, which would in fact bind us. So your initial point that this is just a use restriction, you're not really saying that ends the analysis, are you?
No, Your Honor. I agree that certainly if you apply the restatement position, then you could make the argument that Mr. Arbogast made, that this is an indirect restraint. However,
so then the two variables here are, was the donation, was the grant back in 1875 a charitable act, or was it just a commercial act? And secondly, the nature of the use restriction, was it a charitable use restriction or not? So imagine in 1875, the grantor granted it at full market value with a use restriction that says you can only use it for my family's John Doe haberdashery store. That would probably fail the indirect alienation principle, wouldn't it?
I think under those facts it might, Your Honor, yes. But obviously so that is not the facts we have in this case. We have
I'm often accused of making things too simple. Let me see if you would accuse me of doing that here. So the key thing here is that the original grant was a donative grant based upon a charitable use, and the use is 100% charitable. Does that make it reasonable from the policy of the common law by itself without any other facts being mentioned?
I believe it would, and that fact is unchallenged on appeal by Canova in this case. That finding of the trial court has not been challenged. And I lastly would point out that Canova has not been able to cite one case from anywhere in the United States where a charitable grant was found to be an unlawful or invalid restraint on alienation. Not one case from anywhere in the country.
Mr. Zelnick,
my time is up.
It has expired. Mr. McCormick, you have 7.5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Brian McCormick, I'm representing the unknown heirs of the original grantors under the 1875 deed, Levi and Edna Lynn. Under the Ham case, which everyone is citing for different reasons, the heirs, both known and unknown, have a potential possibility of reverter, which is a property right, and I see my role as guardian ad litem to try to protect that right if indeed it's enjoyed by the unknown heirs. I think all the parties agree that some version of a rule of reason has to be applied to the 1875 deed to decide whether the restrictions in the deed and the reverter provision are valid. Canova, both in its petition for appeal and in its opening brief, says, I quote, "The legal issue in this case is whether the restraint and accompanying reverter are reasonable or unreasonable." In Carniel v. Kendig in 1955, the court said that there's no adequate general definition of reasonableness, but if a restraint on alienation is reasonable, it is valid. And moving forward to Ham, a far more recent case, the court held that courts generally uphold conditions that affect later alienation rights if, under all the circumstances of the case, the restraint is found to be reasonable. The restatement first in analyzing of property first in analyzing forfeiture restraints holds that forfeiture restraints are generally valid if, using almost identical wording to what was used in Ham, they are reasonable under all the circumstances. The restatement of property third, section 3.4, says that use restraints, and I believe the restraint on the church property is a use restraint, restricting it to the use of the Baptist church, Use restraints are not direct restraints. They're indirect restraints governed by the following section, 4.5 of the Restatement Third. And under that section, indirect restraints are judged by a test of whether there's a rational justification for the restriction, and whether the justification is rational is informed by whether the grantor imposing the restriction had a legitimate interest in doing so. Going back to 4.4 and direct restraints, comments C and I are to the effect that it is natural that severe restraints be imposed when the purpose of the restraint is to perpetuate the function of a charity. The reporter's note for that same section, 4.4, makes the point that a factor in determining the reasonableness of a direct restraint, and direct restraints obviously are far more burdensome than indirect restraints, but even a direct restraint, if it's imposed on a charity, that has to be considered as a factor militating in favor of the restraint being reasonable. The restatement first of property is helpful because it gives examples of fee simple determinables, and I think everybody, all the parties in this case, agree the 1875 deed is a fee simple determinable, and it gives examples, and one is a grant to a county for a courthouse conditioned on reversion if the use as a courthouse was ever discontinued by the county. I can't find a meaningful distinction between that deed as a model fee simple determinable deed and the 1875 deed, nor the deed in School Board versus Dowell, which had, for all intents and purposes, identical provisions only applying to a school. And as Mr. Zelnick pointed out, the Supreme Court, your court, had no problems with the reversion taking place when the school use was abandoned. As Mr. Zelnick said, we've stated numerous cases, many from treatises like Amjur and ALR, all stating that restraints on alienations connected with charities are sui generis and are entitled to protection, just as Mr. Zelnick said, the rule against perpetuities does not apply to charities because public policy has made the determination that certain uses in perpetuity are not bad, they're good, they're socially valuable, and that, for example, the perpetuation of prayer and worship is not something we want to necessarily discourage. And I don't think it's coincidence that that Canova hasn't produced cases saying that, per se, restraints on alienation imposed upon charities, even if they are perpetual and even if they are very severe, are necessarily invalid. I'm not saying there could not be an invalid restraint if it had nothing to do with the charity, like the shirt the pastor wore or whatever, but it's not a coincidence that cases to the contrary of the position that Mr. Zelnick and I take, I don't think they can be found, but if they can, they're certainly in a minority. And I would also note that Canova, in its petition for appeal, says, almost telling us about its plight, that no one knowing about the restrictions of the 1875 deed would have loaned money and taken back a deed of trust on the property. And I think that's contrary to Canova's argument, because they're saying the restrictions on the property are void. So someone knowing that should have a certain interest in purchasing the property. But be that as it may, the reason that it is true, as a matter of fact, that no one would buy or take the property as security, the reason that that's true is because these restraints are valid. And the only person, or the only entity stuck with the property, were Virginia Commerce Bank and now Canova, and they're stuck with it because they didn't know about those restrictions. And what they're asking the court to do, essentially, is bail them out of their predicament that's grounded in a bad title search. That's all I have, if there are no questions.
Could I follow up with that last point? I missed that in reading this file. So is the failure of the title search to pick up on this in the record?
Yes. In fact, it's outlined in the statement of facts.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you
much. Well, when I say what Mr. Zelnick said, what happened was the title search went back to 1900, so it didn't find it. So I think it was a matter of record in the land records, and it is admitted by Canova in their statement of facts and their petition for appeal. They outline the chronology of how the title descended first from Commerce Bank, then United Bank took over Commerce Bank, then United Bank, I think, transferred it to Canova.
I see.
So yes, it is in the record. It's in the stipulations in the trial court, and it's also—
That's very helpful. Thank you very much, counsel. Okay. I appreciate that.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Your time has expired, and Mr. Arbogast, you have 1 minute, 38 seconds.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. I'd like to just make three quick points. First, the trial court did not find that this was a gift. The trial court explicitly found that this was for stated consideration as recited in the deed. Second, with respect to the Dow case, and I think this relates to a question earlier, the grant in the Dow case was to be used as a school, which is all well and good because there are a number of people who can operate a school, and so it does not absolutely restrain alienation. It's similar to if the 1875 deed said to be used as a church. What it did not say is it did not say to be used as ABC school operated by XYZ. It was not so specific as the 1875 deed, which is the distinction in what makes this unreasonable. And third, there's a lot of talk about charities being favored and so on. And so I'd like to quote from this court's decision in Collins, which is, charities are favored by the court. The charitable trust is subject to the directions of the court of equity, and if the accumulation should become unreasonable, the court has the power to direct the trustee to disregard it. And that goes to the point, which is, for the trust instrument, it is valid because it's subject to the direction of a court of equity, and it can approve a sale when and as necessary, but not when all that we have left is a real property restriction. And that's consonant.
Could a chancellor in a case like this, hypothetically, if the Woodbine Baptist Church happened to disappear in any real sense, could a chancellor reform the use restriction and allow it to be broadened to the next level of abstraction, which is any Baptist church?
I think my time has expired. May I answer your question, Your Honor?
Answer the question.
In 2005, yes, a chancellor could have done that because the property still would have been owned by the trustees and it would not be transferred out of trust. In 2021, when trust is broken and it's no longer subject to the direction and control of a chancellor in a court of equity, the answer is no. All that we have left is a real property restriction, and that's why it's void under the real property rules.
Justice Kelsey, has he answered your question?
He has, Chief. Thank you.
All right. Your time has expired. The clerk will call the next case.